We call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
And we call the Senate Business, Economic Development, and Transportation Committee to order. Richard.
We have an informational hearing from the revenue staff.
Oh, it's the ever-popular cost responsibility study.
I just love the name. I love the name.
Chair Byron, Chair Burdick, and members of Senate Transportation and Revenue. I don't have much to add to except that I want to introduce the people who will be introducing the study for you. Just wanted to mention that the highway cost allocation study is a constitutionally required study that we do every 2 years, and this is what makes it, if you want to pass the transportation finance degree, you have to have this required course. It's not an elective. You have to listen to it. So by that, we will get the presentation. This study is primarily supervised and worked with the Office of Economic Analysis, the state economist. Tom Pitowski is here, and with him is Carl Carl Batten from Eco Northwest, who are the consultants that did the study for us. So I will vacate my chair and give it to them.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski with the Office of Economic Analysis, and as Mazen told you, with me today is Carl Batten and Sarah Damon from Eco Northwest, who were the lead contractors on the two highway cost allocation studies that you'll hear today. With that, and as Carl said, our role is as managers to provide an independent look at these studies and to make sure that things are on the up and up and it's done as scientifically and unpolitically as possible. With that, I'll just turn it over to Carl.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Carl Batten. I'm with Eco Northwest. We're the consultants hired to do the study. Highway cost allocation has been done in Oregon since 1937, and since 1999 the state constitution has required a study every 2 years and also requires the adjustment of revenue sources if the study shows that light and heavy vehicles aren't paying their fair share of the costs. The study review team had 11 members this time and provided invaluable assistance with data collection and thinking through the issues and with making sure that the interests of the various interested parties were fully represented. So the question that the highway cost allocation asks is, do various classes of highway users pay user fees in proportion to the costs they impose on the highway system? To answer that, we need to define some user classes, allocate costs to the user classes, attribute revenues to the user classes, and then to see if it balances, we calculate equity ratios, which are the share of revenues that a particular class pays divided by the share of the cost that that class imposes. So if the equity ratio comes out to 1.0, that means that they're paying exactly their fair share. If it's less than 1.0, they're paying less than their fair share. If it's more, they're paying more than their fair share. For the 2011 study, we actually did two studies using two different approaches. In the traditional approach, budgeted expenditures are assumed to represent costs. And in the efficient fee approach, we look at the costs imposed by each vehicle in the vehicle classes and add them up to get an estimate of the costs imposed by that vehicle class. Revenue attribution is the same in both approaches. So in the traditional approach, the costs that are allocated are the budgeted expenditures over the upcoming biennium. And the expenditure of federal funds is included because the federal funds are interchangeable with state funds. Expenditures by local governments of state funds are included, and expenditures by local governments of federal funds and of some own source funds are included because those are interchangeable. The local own source funds that are not included are those that are dedicated to particular projects. So, for example, if a bond is issued to build a particular project, that money is not interchangeable with state or federal money, and that's not included in this study because this is about the state revenue instruments. Under the efficient fee approach, the costs are modeled as if each vehicle paid a set of fees when it was driving, and those fees accurately reflected the cost that vehicle was imposing. So wear and tear charges are based on the vehicle weight and configuration and on the characteristics of the road and bridges that vehicle travels on. Congestion charges are based on the amount of cost imposed on other users by delaying those other users on congested roads. They vary with the particular road and with the time of day. Emissions charges are based on the amount of emissions, and those can vary with weight, speed, fuel type, and the location of travel. The bottom line results of the two studies came out very similar. In the traditional approach, the light vehicle equity ratio was 0.9954, which is close enough to one that errors in the data could easily be on the other side. The efficient fee approach came out to 0.9873. Again, that's within the error band of one. Within the various vehicle classes on the heavy vehicle side, some are overpaying and some are underpaying. The lightest heavy vehicles, those under 26,000 pounds, were shown to be overpaying. Most vehicles between 26,001 and 78,000 pounds, that's the vehicles who pay on Schedule A, are underpaying. And vehicles over... and then the 78,000 to 80,000 pound vehicles were shown to be overpaying by quite a bit, and that's the largest single class, accounting for 44% of heavy vehicle miles traveled. And then most vehicles over 80,000 pounds are underpaying, with the heaviest vehicles underpaying by the most. The recommendations coming out of the traditional study are that no changes to rates are necessary for light-heavy fairness and proportionality. That is, the constitutional test is met. And Chapter 7 of the traditional report, which you should have been given a copy of, describes some revenue-neutral changes to rate structures that could improve equity within heavy vehicles. In the efficient fee study, efficient fee has five different components. There's a congestion charge based on the cost of delay imposed on others by a vehicle traveling on a congested road. There's a wear and tear charge for roads, a wear and tear charge for bridges, an emissions charge, and a charge for administrative and other costs.
What's the emission charge for?
That's and it's an estimate of the costs imposed on everyone by the emissions from a vehicle as it operates. Mm-hmm. So there's health costs, and in the case of carbon dioxide, global warming costs, and so on. Mm-hmm. And property damage from emissions. So we estimate the share of efficient fee charges that would be paid by each vehicle class and call that their share of costs. And then we compare the share of costs to the share of revenue under current law instruments and rates. The congestion charge is determined by the cost of delay imposed on others. It varies with volume and capacity, and we assume that the charge can change as traffic conditions change. Since the fee wouldn't actually be charged, we use current volumes to determine the shares of cost. and then we scale the total amount of revenue collected to add up to the revenue that would be generated if efficient fees were charged. And it turns out that if efficient fees were actually charged, the amount of revenue would be about half what the charge would be if you take the costs imposed under current travel patterns. And even after cutting it in half, they would generate $209 million of annual revenue. And light vehicles would pay 96% of that. The wear and tear charge is determined by the cost of preservation and maintenance imposed on the system by the vehicles that use it. It varies with the weight and configuration of the vehicle and with the strength and condition of the roads and bridges. Wear and tear charges would generate $453 million for roads and $163 million for bridges, or $616 million total. And light vehicles would pay 37% of the wear and tear charges. The emissions charge is determined by the cost that emissions imposed on everyone. It, in many cases, could most easily be charged as a per unit of fuel rather than per mile. Emissions charges would generate $493 million of revenue, and light vehicles would pay two-thirds of that. The emissions charges paid by highway users could be used to offset administrative and other costs, and for the purpose of this study, we assume they will be. The remaining administrative and other costs require additional revenue of $239 million, and we modeled that as a flat per mile charge that would be paid 93% by light vehicles because they account for 93% of the vehicle miles traveled in Oregon. So to get to a more efficient system, which was one of the reasons we were asked to do the efficient fee study, was to look at ways of making the system more efficient, charging vehicles for the cost they impose at the times and places they travel sends the users the right price signals to use the existing facilities efficiently. Highway users would adjust their behavior to best meet their own needs given the cost they impose on everyone. And as a special benefit, when each vehicle is paying the cost it imposes, there will be no more need for highway cost allocation studies. And then the other very important side of getting to efficiency is optimal investment in capacity preservation and maintenance. So highway agencies would adjust their behavior to best meet the needs of highway users, and where it's cost-effective, capacity can be provided by investing in alternative modes as well as in investing in more roads. The first step to all of this is better data. We need many more functioning traffic counters in Oregon. Questions?
Sorry, this backs me up a little bit, but you had one category that was 78,000 to 80,000 pounds. Why such a narrow range for that particular arena?
We divide the heavy vehicles into 2,000-pound weight increments because the weight mile tax system charges different rates for each 2,000-pound increment. And that particular increment, that's the highest increment in the Schedule A rates, is the most popular. One of the reasons is that a lot of trucks don't know from day to day exactly how much they're going to weigh for the next load. So they declare their weight to be 80,000 pounds, and that means they're legal carrying anything up to 80,000 pounds. And they often are actually weigh significantly less than 80,000 pounds, which is one of the reasons that when we look at the cost those vehicles are imposing, it comes out lower than the rates would suggest.
Anyone else? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question on congestion. What's the interrelationship between congestion and TPR access management, all those things that contribute or mitigate congestion? I mean, how does that factor into the cost for the vehicle?
In the efficient fee approach, we don't look at the expenditures on access management or TPR or anything. We look at the costs of delay that are imposed by adding another vehicle to the stream of vehicles that are already there. So the cost imposed by the marginal vehicle or the last vehicle you add is the additional time it takes to travel across that segment of road for everybody in there, including that user, times the number of vehicles there minus one, because that user is already paying for the cost he imposed on himself in his delay. So that's the cost that times the value of time for all the users, and that's the cost that the that's imposed on all the other users of the road by having another vehicle there. So at that level of traffic, that's the efficient charge. And
a follow-up. So I'm not sure where capacity plays into that. I guess I'm thinking of Trip 97 and you know, congestion can be created by a lot of things that can also be fixed, mostly by development, and the developer is the one that's paying it, not the vehicle cost. So I don't know. I just was curious on how you relate those two: capacity, congestion, what the true cost of congestion is, whose fault the congestion is, who's going to pay to mitigate the congestion, et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah, we just look at what trying to estimate the true cost of congestion to the highway users. If the cost of fixing it is less than that, then spending the money to fix it would benefit everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Guess not. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Mass and Medical Legislative Revenue Office again. Just to mention a couple things. In the handout that you have, you would have two at the end, two schedules. One is for the what's called the traditional method, and one is for the efficient fee. Just to explain what the efficient fee, the traditional method is what we have constitutionally required to be done. That's a traditional method presentation that you have. The efficient fee is a new way of allocating costs that was mandated by the House Bill 2001. House Bill 2001 saw, that's the of the 2009 session, last session, saw that the future is coming with a different way of looking at highway cost allocation and how we are going to allocate costs. So it kind of required that let's try to find a way that we develop the data that will start looking at the congestion pricing and the emission and the other things that the traditional fee does not look at. So the efficient fee, if you will, is the elective rather than the required. But this is the first time we do the efficient fee, and I think part of the conclusion by the consultants that if we need to do it any more time, we need more data and investment in that. But this is a House Bill 2001 requirement. The two other quick reports that we have to share with you today is one about the flat fee payments. The flat fee is one way of paying that is required to be studied also every 2 years by the Department of Transportation. They will, Greg Del Ponte here will give you a quick analysis or a quick review of what the study found, and finally also what we would share with you is another requirement of House Bill 2001. House Bill 2001 required the Department of Transportation to look into congestion pricing, do a congestion pricing pilot, and to report back to you in this session. So also the Department of Transportation will give you a quick review of that pilot as well. So
they didn't look like
that. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Beyer, Madam Chair Burdick, members of both committees, my name is Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator of ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Coming around is my formal testimony regarding the conduct of the flat fee study using 2009 data. I'll summarize it and give you some context. You've heard a little bit from the previous presentation that commercial motor carriers in Oregon generally pay a weight mile tax. It's based on the miles traveled and the declared weight of the vehicle. Motor carriers reporting and paying weight mile tax have a burden of some record keeping to record miles traveled as the configurations at which they travel change throughout the course of the day and the week. The Oregon flat fee payment option originated in 1949 as a way to make road use tax reporting easier for log haulers who at that time and still today regularly use non-public roads. You can look at it this way. Since many of those log carriers at the time were very small, They frequently made many short trips on and off the public highway in the course of a day. In many instances, that motor carrier is described as a husband driving the log truck during the day, performing maintenance on the truck after work, and his wife likely did the paperwork on the kitchen table once the evening dinner dishes were cleared away. The flat fee option was meant to ease the record-keeping burden on those carriers. And after the option was made available to log haulers originally in 1949, it was further extended to sand and gravel haulers in 1969, and then again to wood chip haulers in 1983. Under existing statute, the option is also available for certain farm trucks operating for hire, but in reality, no farm trucks take advantage of the flat fee option. Oregon revised statute does require the department to conduct a flat fee study in every even-numbered year and to present the results to each legislative session. The idea here is that we are charged to determine if flat fee filers, as a class, not individually, are paying an equivalent amount of tax that they would have paid as a class had they reported and paid all the miles on a mileage basis as opposed to a flat fee basis. To fulfill that requirement, ODOT contracts with Dr. Catherine Lawson from the University at Albany in New York to conduct the study. Her report dated September 2010 is appended to my written testimony, which you have in front of you. And she has found that some carriers choosing to pay the flat fee paid more and some paid less than they might have paid had they chose to pay the weight mile tax itself. But before we react to the study results, I think it's important that we understand the whole idea of a flat fee involves estimation. So it's unlikely we're ever going to see absolute parity. It's all about getting as close as we can. And so in that light, it's appropriate, I think, to consider the revision of tax rates as we observe and trend the study reports over time, as they're repetitively done. And if you look at the most two recently concluded studies, comparing the 2009 results to the 2007 results, the gaps are getting smaller as opposed to getting larger. So across the board, we're moving in the right direction. When you consider that against the fact that the flat tax rates along with the weight mile tax rates, were last adjusted upwards effective in October 2010 as a result of the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act. And because of the uncertainty in motor carrier operations, because of the economic downturn that we have seen in recent years, it seems to make sense to continue with the current rates and monitor future changes. Again, since the current study indicates we're getting closer as opposed to farther apart. So, as a formal recommendation, ODOT does not recommend any changes to the flat fee rate as a result of the 2010 study. In addition, I consulted with attorneys at the Department of Justice, and they concur in that recommendation. That's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Questions? Today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, may I address the committee?
Senator Starr.
So we're about to hear from Mr. Tell about the congestion pricing pilot. I'd just like to remind colleagues here at the rostrum that in Senate Bill 128, which the Senate passed, we deleted this particular section of House Bill 2001, Jobs and Transportation Act. So you'll get to hear a little bit about the where we are in the pilot, and if the bill passes the House, this would be the last time that Mr. Tell will present to a legislative committee on this particular pilot.
And as I recall, this was your pet project.
Yes, it was.
Thank you very much. My name is Jason Tell, and I'm ODOT's Region 1 manager based in Portland. And I've been asked to give a briefing on congestion pricing, and as Senator Starr said, there is some legislation pending. But I do think that there was some really good work done and some lessons learned that came out of this pilot that we want to share with you today. The 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act requires ODOT and partner jurisdictions in the Portland area to implement a congestion pricing pilot in the Portland area. The pilot program has really been a catalyst for advancing our understanding of congestion pricing and how it might better manage congestion in the Portland area. Unlike prior studies that have been done in Oregon that really focused on long-range planning sort of exercises, this was really different because we really looked at what it would take to implement pricing. The effort, as I said, has been collaborative and involved a lot of the top elected officials in the Portland region, including the mayor of Portland. The three counties had representatives, had commissioners, and the Metro Council president. And this is an important point because in those areas where congestion pricing was successful, there was strong political support. The evaluation process and technical analysis was done over a year and a half, and it looked both at the effects of congestion pricing on specific locations, but also on the transportation system as a whole. Public opinion research was conducted, which helped add additional insight into the study, and together these lessons helped us come up with a proposal for a pilot in the Portland area, but also points out some things going on at the statewide level and at the national level. So before I get into the details of what came out of the group that worked on this, I want to talk a little bit about how we got there. CPAC, which is the Congestion Pricing Advisory Committee, which is those elected officials I mentioned, and a Technical Advisory Committee, or TAC, with technical support from ODOT and consultants, were formed after the 2009 legislative session, and we created an evaluation framework to look at a wide range of options to consider studying. And during this time, the committee met many times and reviewed a lot of information. So I'm going to give you the quick summary here, but there's a lot of good information if anyone's interested in the details and the studies that went into this. The proposals of what to consider were solicited from the CPAC members in the fall of 2009, and then they were screened based on some minimum selection criteria. And those were that there were one or more local jurisdictions that sponsored the effort, that if any adjacent jurisdictions were impacted by the proposal, that they also support studying it, and that the proposal could meet the September 2012 implementation date, which was set in JTA, and also that make sure that we had some reasonable chance of success in implementing it. After completing the screening process, there were three projects that were chosen for more detailed evaluation, and those three projects are Cornelius Pass Road, looking at a single point time of day toll on Oregon 217, looking at on-ramp tolling on selected ramps, and then the City of Portland had a parking management proposal or set of proposals that they submitted. These different proposals were evaluated based on a set of criteria. First of all, was the degree of public support for the stated policy objectives. So for each one of these proposals, there's a specific policy objective stated as to why we would consider pricing. So for instance, on Cornelius Pass Road, the concept was by pricing, could we raise enough money to pay for safety improvements to make the road safer? We also looked at the effectiveness of the proposal at meeting a policy objective. The question is, could you do it effectively with pricing so that people can compare that to doing it in other ways? We identified affected areas and stakeholders, quantified the direct effects to highway users, looked at the overall benefits and costs, and then also looked at the degree of public support for a specific for each specific proposal. And throughout the development of the proposals, we gave updates to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and we gave written reports here to the legislature. So what did we learn from the effort, and what did the committee recommend? So after a year and a half's worth of work, on April 4th, the advisory committee met, and there were really four key findings that the group came away with. First of all, traffic diversion is a major challenge to tolling and pricing in a single location. And what really surprised the group, I think, is the degree at which people will choose to take alternate routes, avoid paying the toll. In the case of Cornelius Pass, any toll rate, even a low toll rate, 50 cents, resulted in about a 50% diversion rate. So huge impact. And what that does is it undermines the economic feasibility of the proposal. It also creates a public acceptance problem, particularly if you're just creating another traffic problem in an adjacent corridor. So what we ended up is looking at with diversion is not raising much revenue and making it difficult with some adjacent problems. So the rest of the transportation system was impacted. As I kind of alluded to, revenue was less than expected. This was in two parts, one because of the diversion I mentioned, and two, the operating costs associated with setting up the toll. There's a capital cost and an ongoing cost for doing that. Third, prior to doing any public outreach in advance of a proposal, it looks like public support is pretty minimal, at least for the ones that we looked at. For example, we asked people and we did polling through Adams Davis Hibbets, 27% said they would support tolling to reduce traffic congestion on Highway 217. 38% said they would support a toll to improve safety on Cornelius Pass Road. When we delved down a little bit deeper to understand why, what are some of the issues people had, 29% of the respondents said that they were skeptical that a pilot proposal would result in improved transportation. 24% questioned the need to pay a fee in addition to a gas tax, and 18% said now is a really bad time given the state of the economy. So those numbers, you know, obviously are not don't get you to a majority in support of doing these things, but we learned a lot about what are the different issues that people are thinking about around pricing. There also were some things we saw that could move those numbers, and so if there were to be additional work done, I think we have some ideas of doing more public opinion research. And then lastly, another key finding was that the Portland parking proposal would provide a good demonstration of how variable time of day charges could influence motorist behavior. So based on those four findings, the committee had two recommendations. The first was to proceed with the Portland parking pricing proposal. That's a mouthful. And so the City of Portland is basically looking at a short-term and a longer-term proposal that they're going to implement. The first is event-related parking around Geldwin Field, and the second is looking in the Northwest District, which currently doesn't have parking pricing at a next step. So right now, because of the selection as a pilot, we've been helping fund some of the research and options that the city looked into, and they're now implementing the Geldwin proposal. The second recommendation that came out of the group was that there's more work that can be done at the regional level and at the statewide level to advance pricing, at least the concept. The first is Metro will be analyzing greenhouse gas scenarios, and so the group recommended that Metro model in one of those scenarios a pricing scenario. And that's important because that pricing scenario would look at if you apply pricing to the entire system, as opposed to what we had to look at in a pilot given the narrow time frame where we had to look at tolling one spot or a couple spots on a single road. With that diversion, you create other problems. So the idea would be through modeling, see what happens if you look at pricing a system of roads as opposed to individual roads. Second, that the Oregon Transportation Commission should update state tolling policies, including pricing, and the group saw this as an advantage to engage the public in more discussion and maybe better understanding about pricing options. And then third, with the Road User Fee Task Force looking at vehicle miles travel tax, urging that group to consider pricing as that concept moves forward. So, in conclusion, the pilot program really has helped us better understand pricing at an implementation level in a way that we haven't looked at before. ODOT and local governments will move forward with implementing those recommendations that came out of the committee. A final report, which will have all the details and detailed technical analysis, will be available at the end of the month if anyone's interested, and we'll share that broadly. And finally, I should thank all the elected officials and staff who are in part of this, because it was a year and a half of a lot of work, and people really were committed to better understanding congestion pricing. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the resistance to tolling, that was just based on you surveying people and saying, what would you do if there was a toll on 217?
We had several different questions that were asked, and we can get you the actual results if you'd like. So the first question that was asked was about meeting a particular objective. So in the case of Highway 217, it was, would you be willing to pay a toll of a certain amount if it reduced congestion? Basically, if your travel time got quicker, would you pay a toll? On the Cornelius Pass Road example, it was really about safety. Using money to improve safety, would you be willing to pay a toll in that instance? They also tested how people reacted to different toll rates, so starting at a low rate, let's say 50 cents, and then going up to $1, $2, et cetera. So there were a number of questions asked that were trying to better understand how people felt about both the objectives and then the specific proposals.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask is it's one thing for somebody to say, you know, they'd take an alternate route, but I know both of those roads pretty well, and neither one of them lends itself easily to alternatives. And so it's one question of, I mean, it seems like I would rather see an actual experiment with something rather than just what people say, because it's real easy to say, oh yeah, I'd take an alternative, and then you wake up and start to go to work in the morning and reality hits you in the face.
Yeah, Chair Byers, Senator Burdick. So the polling data was collected, and there was also modeling done that tries to predict the travel behavior, which is not perfect by any means, but Metro does have the best that is available. So I think everything I just said you have to take given that context that, you know, we're trying to predict behavior here.
Other questions? That's all you want to say on your pet project?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's it? More.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, these are the reports we have for you today. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be coming back next session for another set of reports.
Okay. Thank you very much.
How do we get credit?
Thank you,
Mazen.
Class. Where do we get credit for this class?
Continuing. Well, you don't have to hear it again for 2 years.
Oh.
Continuing legislative education.
Huh?
Continuing
okay.
Legislative education.
The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned.
All right. So looks like we're back in information. We lost our members again.
Madsen has to work on a revenue for our next bill because it isn't done yet. So he's going to go work on that.
So he's going to go work on that. On these, okay. So.
Express
the real. Oh, I know.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
You're welcome to say. This is exciting.
You don't mean it.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2332. Richard.
House Bill 2332 allows a tow truck operator to transport property for hire.
Welcome, Al.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me today is Mike Wagner on the tow truck board, former chairman of the board and school board member in his area of the world. Appreciate having the hearing today on House Bill 2332. Basically, what this does is gives towers the opportunity to change the way and to expand their businesses. Currently, under a tow plate, we are only allowed to tow wrecked and disabled vehicles. That's all we can do. Some in our industry, those that own trucks over 26,001, would like to haul commodities with their trucks. They cannot do this, however, because of the restriction of the current tow plate. This bill sets forth a new classification for tow vehicles 26,001 pounds and over. This classification allows them to haul commodities. At the time they register the vehicle, the tow truck owner can determine if he or she wants to use the truck to haul commodities and tow, or they can use the vehicle to just tow wrecked and disabled vehicles. If they choose to haul commodities and tow, they pay a registration rate that is in line with the trucking industry. The Oregon Tow Truck Association greatly acknowledges Mr. Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, who worked with us on this bill, and we have their support, and Mr. Greg Del Ponte, head of the Motor Carrier Division of ODOT, who we also worked on this bill with. We'd also like to thank Representative Bentz and Representative Beyer for helping us bring this issue forward.
Okay.
That concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Senator Beyer and the members of the committee, my name is Mike Wagner. I'm with Sandy. I'm towing up in Lyons, Oregon. And what this bill is really about is the equipment has changed from when the rules were written, and some of the guys that run the heavy trucks we're not talking about the traditional tow trucks that you're the big three-axle truck with the big boom. We're talking about trailers primarily that this will be used for. The sliding axle trailers are being used in our industry to haul different sorts of vehicles, and those trailers are expensive, and they sit around, and we're limited to what we can do with them. So this will allow guys that have the companies that have invested in the expensive equipment to do specialty work to be able to do some other work also and pay the appropriate fees for that. And the problem now is they have to make a decision. If they register it normally, they can't use it on the wrecks, and if they register for wrecks, they can't use it for normal work. So this would allow them to pay the proper fees and use that equipment for other things other than just the limited scope of towing. So, thank you.
Questions from Mike Arell? Senator Bird?
I'm just curious. I'm having trouble visualizing, but how did it ever get to be that they could use them on wrecks but not normal work, or on normal work but not wrecks? I don't get how that happened in the first place.
It has to do with the towers have to sign up with the state police to be on a list that they get called for to do the wrecked work, and the state police requires you to have a TW plate to be on that list. So if you take that vehicle and register so you can do other work, then it doesn't qualify for the police list any longer. It's an idiosyncrasy of how the registration works.
It has to do with the new technology. The old technology, they couldn't do it, but with the new technology, they can take other things besides cars, because the thing goes like this.
Thank you for the visual aid. I think my car got taken away on one of those runs. It's sounding familiar.
This is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, it was a good thing at the time since it was in the process of burning up.
Other questions?
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Representative. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Bentz,
District 60. I apologize for being late. I was in another meeting and just wanted to make sure I let you know I support this bill. I enjoy the opportunity to represent a number of folks in the towing business. They've asked for the support. The reason, of course, is that in the wintertime they have lots of business. In the summer, which is very long in my part of the world, their trucks sit idle and they desperately would like to have something else they could be using them for. So I hope I'm on the right bill. But
You're on the right bill.
that indeed is my reason for being here, to let you know that this would help our economy, and in particular the folks that have the towing businesses.
And that's probably why it came out of your committee unanimously.
Might have something to do with it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions of the representative? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Let's go back to work. That is all that I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Representative Nathanson, are you here on...
No, she's on the next one.
You're on the next one. Okay.
Do we want to move this or do we want to wait?
We want to move it.
I'm good.
So, is there anybody else who wishes to testify before I close the public hearing? We'll close public hearing on House Bill 2332 and open a work session. And the chair would move House Bill 2332 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Sounds like a good government bill to me.
Good government bill. Oh, good.
21st century bill.
Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, going once, twice. 2332A is passed to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. We'll adjourn that work session. Senator Starr, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Senator Starr will carry. We'll open a public hearing on 2370. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Welcome.
Nancy Nathanson, state representative from District 13. This bill is about thinking ahead, about improving the state's freight and passenger rail system, and about communication. Currently, publicly owned land can be disposed of without consideration for the potential use for rail expansion. That could hamper the ability for rail improvements for the infrastructure, like for an additional siding or a parallel track, maybe a separated grade crossing. Reacquiring land, then, that's been lost can be a lengthy process and costly. Seems like it would be a real shame to lose property already in public ownership just to find out that it could have been useful and the only reason it was lost is that no one knew that it might be useful. There just wasn't enough communication. The objective of this bill is to ensure that ODOT is notified when publicly owned land in proximity to an existing rail right-of-way is being sold or transferred. It doesn't happen often, but it can happen. In fact, it's happened in my own community, and we've seen maps where it can happen in several other communities. This bill is limited to notification only for public property owners, not for private property, and all it covers is simple notification. That communication has been lacking, and ODOT, cities, and the railroads have said this could be beneficial. The League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties have reviewed the proposal and said it does not impose a significant burden on other public entities. That's because it doesn't happen very often that there's publicly owned land that close to a rail right-of-way. This bill simply requires public agencies to notify ODOT 30 days prior to the sale or other sorts of transfer of publicly owned land within 100 feet of an existing rail line or 500 feet of an at-grade crossing. You know that there are safety concerns at some at-grade crossings, and there are many places around the state where we know we could improve rail by extending a siding or putting in a parallel track. This bill does not require ODOT to purchase the property, and it doesn't require that the local public entity sell the property to ODOT or anyone else. It makes no such requirement, just encourages the communication that this property is now available. Does someone find it useful? It does mean that ODOT will have the opportunity to let the other agency know that they may have an interest in it, and ODOT will also be notifying the railroads, because it could be that the railroads themselves would have wanted to acquire the property if only they had known it was coming up for sale. I hope you'll agree that this idea can be a useful tool to keep our eye on properties such as this. Expanding our current rail infrastructure is of critical importance to this state's economy for the future. We need to improve our capacity to ship freight, whether it's manufacturing or agricultural products. We need to get our products to market, and we need to improve our passenger rail system as well. So I hope you will agree that this kind of a communication is a first step toward helping. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burton.
So you didn't get any resistance from the standpoint of maybe people not wanting to show their hand that they're going to sell property or anything like that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, when the bill first included right of first refusal or first opportunity to purchase, there was some resistance about the notification and how long would property be offline while ODOT or a railroad might be wanting to start negotiate. After it was clarified what kind of notice it would be and the length of time and that opportunity for first right of refusal was removed, there wasn't that kind of opposition anymore.
Okay.
It was narrowed to be just strictly the communication.
Did this come out of the same good government task force that we've been hearing your bills and revenue?
Mr. Chair and Senator, no, it did not. This was just from me. It was from my awareness of what's happened in some areas. I've been working on rail issues for a long time. And
We definitely need to improve rail throughout the country and in this state. So I think this is a good bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Drubb.
I'm going to try to talk here, but the problem, I represent 18 little cities. And big cities, I can understand where this is advantageous to. I try to apply that to Mill City, Oregon. Or I try to apply to Staten, Oregon, or some of the host of other little cities I have with railroad tracks through it. And it seems to me like this would be more of an impediment than it would be to any benefit. And this, all it does is delay the sale maybe 30 days and discourage a buyer. Whereas, you know, I can understand it for mass transit, I can understand it for major rail lines, but little cities, I don't see the advantage to this, and I think it would be a detriment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, when we were first thinking about what kind of notice might be appropriate, we were thinking, well, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and it was agreed that it's hard for an entity to always know so far in advance, such as 90 days, that they might want to be disposing of property that they own. Once it was determined that 30 days is a pretty short notice and that it's very likely that any public entity would have advance thoughts about, you know, thoughts let's say 30 days, just a month in advance, that they're going to dispose of property. But it's not actually delaying a sale at all, because their paperwork would continue, you know, getting things ready and prepared for putting it on the market would continue. And 30 days just seemed like the reasonable amount of time to make sure that we weren't delaying or getting in the way of anyone's ability to conduct business the way they wanted to.
Well, back to the small city model, most of the time if they're going to sell something, it's because they have an offer from somebody to buy it. So, I mean, it really does impede, you know, the potential of that sale. And I'm trying to think of the benefits to a small city that they would have, you know, Mill City's like 1,500 people. So it isn't like they're looking at it for mass transit or anything like that. So tell me what the advantages will be for a little city, and I might vote for it. Otherwise, I think it's a no vote.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, two points. When I spoke with the representatives from the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, I asked, how often is this going to happen that a public agency owns property this close to a rail right-of-way? The answer came back, most of them don't at all, that it's pretty rare that there's property owned that close to a right-of-way. I think an advantage for small cities is when I think about what happened when Coos Bay almost lost, well, they had lost access, and when we almost lost the line between Coos Bay in toward the Willamette Valley, the short line, what almost happens to small communities sometimes when they might lose access, or when you find out that producers can't get their products to market by rail, which is a very economical and generally more economical means. I think that small cities are just as interested in efficient rail as important for their manufacturers or agricultural products, for example. So I think that the advantage is that we are supporting a very efficient transportation system to support the economy.
Okay, even reading the bill closer, the gentleman that was just up here was from Lyons, Oregon. I happened to technically be from Lyons, Oregon. The rail goes through there. There's an intersection that crosses with the road to Albany. 500 feet would pretty much take it almost out of the city limits on one side. I mean, we're not talking huge cities here. So for a small city with the intersection, 500 feet from the intersection, that's not a small distance for a small town. I mean, it's quite a ways. So I'm sorry, but I think I'm going to be a no vote.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Jerry Bohart and Craig Honeyman. Welcome.
Afternoon, Senator Beyer, Chair Burdick, and committee members. For the record, I'm Jerry Bohart. I'm the Interim Deputy Director of Operations. And here with regards to House Bill 2370-A, and ODOT supports it. I don't know that there's much to add with what Representative Nathanson talked about. We did work with her on this bill. We do see it as a key communications notification with regards to opportunities that might be there with regards to both passenger rail and freight rail. It does require rulemaking, so we'll be able to hopefully identify a process that is very streamlined and very efficient for the various communities. And there is also an opportunity within the rulemaking to clearly articulate what corridors we would be talking about that we would want to do this notification. So it's conceivable that some of the small short line corridors, they may not be ones that we would identify as needing the notification. And we also did make it clear that this did not apply to light rail corridors. So I think those were some of the additional clarifications that we worked on throughout this process. So with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Jerry, have you ever seen the lack of this as a problem where you missed an opportunity?
Chair Beyer, you know, I haven't worked enough with rail to really know the answer to that, but I think as we look at how many our short lines, how those lines have been lost in the past, the number of lines that have been lost in the past, I think those would have been opportunities that we might have done something different if we had been notified ahead of time. So,
okay, questions? Good.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Craig Honeyman, League of Oregon Cities. I'm here testifying in support of House Bill 2370A. We are, as Representative Nathanson indicated, we were happy to be consulted on this measure during the summer and during the run-up to the consideration of this legislation by this legislature. Basically, concur with her comments that this is now basically a communications bill. And that at a time when the state needs to be resourceful in exploring all modes of transportation, it's a good idea. We need to avoid lost opportunities to for the future of rail strategies and future rail infrastructure. We will be engaged and interested in the rulemaking that Ms. Bohart just referred to. If I could be responsive to Senator Girard's comments, first of all, I appreciate, Senator, those comments. As we were talking about this bill internally within the league, with the members, city members, we were able to ascertain that disposal of these kinds of properties is fairly rare. I did not get any feedback or pushback from small cities in particular on this bill. There were some other concerns, frankly, raised by some larger cities, which have been addressed since the bill was considered in the House. So with that, we're pleased to support House Bill 2370A.
Any questions?
Great.
No questions?
Good.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2370? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on... Oh, do you have anything for the record?
Yeah, there is one letter from Brenda Wilson, Intergovernmental Relations Manager from the City of Eugene, in support of the measure that's been handed out.
All right, we will close the public hearing on 2370. And what do we got? Do we have anything on 2329?
Yeah, I now have the revenue for that amendment, so we can move that if we want.
Okay, so we'll open the work session on 2329. Richard?
House Bill 2329 amends the statutory definitions of all-terrain vehicles to add a Class 4 vehicle type, and it expands the membership to 13 members on the All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee. We heard this on May 10th, and there was also a Dash 6 amendment which expands the membership of the All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee to 14 members to include a person who represents persons with disabilities. There was minimal revenue and minimal fiscal impact on the original bill, and there's minimal revenue and minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 6 amendments.
We haven't adopted the 6s, have
we? We have not.
Yeah. We move the Dash A6s to 2329.
Senator Atkinson has moved the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2329. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Dash 6s are adopted. Senator?
I would move 2329 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2329 as amended by the Dash 6s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 2329 as amended by the Dash 6 is moved to the floor. Unanimous. And Senator Atkinson, since you really are still asking for this thing, I think it would be appropriate for you to carry this bill.
From the Lord, you mean?
Yes, or whoever else you think is going to get you that Polaris. Is there anything else to come before the committee? There is none. We've adjourned.